Welcome to Market View with Ike Ios and Friends. This show that not only reveals and analyzes the inside story on today's market news, but also uncovers the areas where investors can make money right now. Market View with Ike Ios and Friends is being brought to you by GM Capital Group.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'm Mike Ios, your host for Market Views. Today's guest, my good friend, Mr. Glenn Ely. Hi, Glenn. How do you do?
Doing pretty good, Ike.
Well, Glenn, I'm pretty excited about today's presentation because it's rather unique, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty unusual, complete departure from what I would normally be doing and requires an incredible amount of research over quite a long period of time. So it's something I've been very interested in for a long time, and it was sort of an obsession of mine for about a year. This project originally started about 15 years ago, and I presented it to a very small group of people then, only about 100 people or so, and no one has really ever seen it since. And the information is still so relevant and so, I think, groundbreaking that when you ask me to do a new interview for a new concept, this was the first thing that I thought of, and I thought it would be a great thing for your listeners to hear.
I know that the presentation examines economic history going back, you know, thousands of years, am I right?
Right. Actually, so about 12,000 years.
How were you able to quantify economic history going back 12,000 years ago?
Well, that's the complicated part, and that's going to take us about 30 minutes for me to explain that. But, I had wondered if there would be any kind of process for quantifying history, because almost everyone in my field, in my business, is always spending all their time trying to predict the future and what's going to happen in the future. And so, again, about 15 years ago, I was just wondering if it would be possible to actually do the exact opposite and quantify history on a numerical basis that had never been quantified before. So instead of going forward, I was trying to go backwards and get an idea of what economic progress was on a epic basis, like on, you know, over thousands and thousands of years. Unfortunately, in an attempt to quantify human progress, I had studied, you know, incredible amounts of information all the way back to the Egyptian and Sumerian civilizations. And the big problem that occurred was that there was just no data of any sort to work with. So it made it almost impossible to arrive at any kind of conclusion about anything. If your listeners can move to chart 3, which should be at the top right corner of the page.
Okay.
That's where I currently am. And actually, the dilemma, which is on the next page, is the problem. You can go actually on to chart 4. The data that we have available that I actually got 15 years ago from the Foundation for the Study of Cycles covers about 200 to 300 years. And you can see in a 12,000-year time frame how little data that is. And so as a result, I really couldn't arrive at any kind of conclusions, obviously, with this kind of information. So it necessitated that I rely on archaeological information and historical information in, you know, books about history, encyclopedias, all kinds of different reference sources. So the only information I was able to obtain was economic data that went back about 1,000 years or to 1,000 AD, and that obviously wasn't quite enough when there's clearly records from the Sumerian civilizations going back about 3,500 years, and there's evidence of agricultural development back about 9,000 years. So trying to figure out a way to use that old information and non-statistical information to construct a long-term chart of human progress and economic progress was really the goal that I had in mind, and I was hoping it would be possible. When I started the project, I had no idea if it was going to even be possible for me to do it. Let's go into chart 5.
Okay.
The purpose of the research was to try, and this was my goal, to try to develop a scientific objective approach to quantifying economic history, or to quantify history in an economic kind of way, and then translate that map of progress, or translate that into a map of human progress. And then I was hoping eventually to use wave theory to merge the past with the present and then forecast into the future even much beyond what I've been able to do in recent talks with you.
Okay.
I went on to chart number 6. To accomplish this, I decided under wave theory, you have some primary requirements before you can actually begin analysis. And one of those primary requirements to do proper analysis is determining the absolute certain point that a new trend begins, like in an uptrend or a downtrend, that you have to know for sure that you're starting your analysis from the proper place. And so I had to figure out a way by studying thousands of years and maybe even hundreds of thousands of years of information to determine a critical turning point in human evolution. Where did we begin this new upward progression in human progress? And to define that point, I had to search quite a long time. Also had to define some kind of foundational principles of what constituted human progress, human evolution, and then figure out a way to quantify that history so that it could be plotted on a chart to then apply wave theory to. So the overall goal was to map this progress from the beginning way back in time all the way to the present and into the future. Let's move on to chart 7.
Okay.
The problem that I've always had with history that I sort of learned in high school, you could say indirectly, is that the way I was taught history is it just seems relatively irrational and random. That there was, I was never taught any kind of guiding principles of why things happened or why people did what they did. It was more just, this is what happened, remember the date. This is what happened, remember the date. You know, and just sort of a news kind of presentation of just the events with no overriding understanding of why things happen, and certainly no idea of any compelling forces that cause things to happen or any reasons beyond just the here and now. So moving on to chart 8.
Okay.
What became obvious to me over time and from studying wave theory is that all periods in human civilization and in nature and the Earth's evolution, there's periods of growth and there's periods of decay, there's periods of production or construction, there's periods of destruction. So you can see this just from looking at a long-term chart of the U.S. stock market, and I think this also merges with European stock markets, that you can see clear periods of growth, clear periods of decay. Moving on to chart number 9, so it was my objective with this project to determine the major turning points, again, so that I could start this analysis process, and to determine a point where we clearly went from a period of decay to a period of growth. And from a human perspective, according to all the things that I read, humans basically lived a nomadic existence, mostly hunting, fishing, gathering plants, and so forth. And this went on for hundreds of thousands of years. There's virtually no evidence of any human progress beyond just the hunting-gathering stage of life until about 12,000 years ago with the conclusion of the previous ice age. And as the previous ice age came to an end, there was the increasing temperatures on the Earth, which then allowed for vegetation to start spreading, which then allowed humans to start spreading across the Earth more. And obviously, if conditions aren't right, it's difficult to for any kind of animal or plant to proliferate if the conditions aren't right. So as the Earth started to warm, the world's population was then allowed to start growing because the habitable land mass started to increase. So that was major event number one that I was looking for. And major event number two occurred with the start of agriculture. And it's because of the increasing temperatures around the Earth that not only did it know, it's become easier to grow plants, but the man actually discovered the ability to manage crops, and all the evidence shows that the start of agriculture began about 9,000 BC. So with the extremely favorable conditions of increasing global temperatures and the discovery of agriculture, I think that's the crucial turning point that I was looking for that showed that man embarked on a new kind of course, a new period of development. Let's move on to chart 10.
Okay.
This gets into some real basic stuff, but you know, regarding why people do what they do, why humans do what they do, there's very basic needs that we all have that will force us to do things. And the basic needs that everyone has, of course, is the need for air, water, sleep, food, clothing, and shelter, and they're pretty much in that order. You know, it's been shown that you can live just a few minutes without air, maybe a few days or maybe a week, I'm not sure the exact amount of time, but maybe a week or so without water, sleep, very short periods of time, and food and so forth. So in order of preference and dominance, those are the basic things that we need. And obviously if we need water or food, that's going to cause us to take action, and it's going to cause us to go out and find that water and food.
Of course.
And if we, say it again?
Of course.
And if we need clothing or shelter, that requires more than just impulsive kind of searching. It requires actually intellectual creativity to satisfy, especially when it comes to shelter. So the greater the need, the more complex the mental requirements to achieve that particular need. So progress is not possible without this human action, and satisfying each need is going to predominantly occur in a sequential kind of order. Let me make sure I'm moving on correctly here. The concept of human needs and the sequentialization of those human needs was discovered or presented originally by Abraham Maslow. And if you move on to the next page, he says that, this is 11A, Abraham Maslow said that man is a wanting animal, and that there's a hierarchy of needs that takes place, and each need must be met before the next need is possible to achieve. And I think it's this need progression that then started man's progress once he was able to proliferate around the earth. So the first stage of need, like I've labeled these stage 1, stage 2, 3, 4, and 5, so I've given them a stage name, not only the names that Abraham Maslow gave them. But when you're dealing with physiological needs, that would be the needs that we talked about earlier, the need for water, food, air. When you move into the safety need, that's the next higher level, and that really can't be met until you've had food and water and oxygen. You need those things first, and once you have those with any level of certainty and you're comfortable, then you can start working on things like safety, which would be clothing to protect yourself, shelter to protect yourself, maybe weapons possibly to protect yourself. But that would move you and allow you to move to stage 2 of human needs. Once you're pretty comfortable with your own safety and you're safe in your surroundings, then it allows you to move to the next level, which allows you to start socializing with people, building possible groups, such as when agriculture got started. People were forced to create small towns and communities because they needed more than one person to help them till the land and pick the crops and so forth. So the 11 belongingness stage is the period of more socialization, interaction, association, and so forth. Once those needs are met, then there's a tendency for certain individuals to want to stick out in the crowd and produce a level of esteem or status or political clout, and that moves into stage 4. Now, this can also be met by a society or by an individual, but generally speaking, as an individual, after you've met your social needs, you want to generally start to gain some power or influence over other people. And then the final stage is the most intellectual stage of development, where you're looking more for the arts, the sciences, the discoveries, creativity, music, things like that. So that's the way that humans satisfy their needs, and in that order. And it occurred to me when I was studying this material by Abraham Maslow that there was no evidence, by the way, that he had applied this to anything but an individual basis, that he had never tried to discuss this in terms of the masses and how it might manifest when you're talking about entire societies. And that was the thing that sort of clicked in my head, that allowed me to believe that it would be possible to quantify history by understanding that there's needs that have to be met in a sequential order. It's also probably not coincidental that these need levels happen to be in five stages, and that the need levels tend to be on an active and a passive kind of basis. Like if you think of your physiological needs, they're more active. It requires real action by you personally to satisfy them. Safety needs are more passive. They're not going out to do something, but you're protecting what you have. The stage three part of the equation is also more active, requiring socialization and going out and meeting people and doing things. The stage four is a little more passive, sort of like consolidation of your power among friends and family and trying to establish yourself, but it's more of a protection of what you have process on a social basis. And then stage five, again, requires more aggressive, intellectual aggressiveness, you might say, creative aggressiveness, and so forth. So it was interesting to note that there could be some correlation there between the personal levels of need and the progression of an economy and a society. So it sort of clicked in my head that maybe it would be possible to use this this process that Abraham Maslow had discovered to actually quantify history. So moving on to chart 11B, it's showing what I mentioned earlier, that you go through this period of potential progression, but at each point in the equation, realize you're building on a prior foundation. When you start at level 1 or stage 1, you can't get to stage 2 until level 1 is met, and you can't get to stage 3 until level 2 is met. But at each point, there's the risk that conditions might change and you'll revert back down to level 2 or to level 1. So with each stage fulfilled, as long as the one below it is very solid, then it allows you to go to the next one and the next one. It means it's very difficult to achieve the top levels of this progression, because all the other needs have to be met with certainty and with comfort, and that doesn't usually happen too easily. Move on to chart 12.
Okay.
What became evident to me is that the sequential fulfillment of human need is the foundation of both personal progress, human progress, and societal and economic progress. Let's go through it on chart 12 for a minute here. One human need, of course, dictates a certain kind of activity, and then that builds into the next one. So if you start off with the first need, which is more of a visceral need, in other words, the need to satisfy physiological requirements, that is the motive for human action. And then the physical need is an incentive for progress, where you're making clothes or making shelter. The social needs would be an incentive for economic progress, especially social progress, the creation of laws for people to get along in a society, the distribution of material items that were maybe created in stage two, and then as those needs and as that activity is met, then you move into the status and the mental needs department, which would be the creation of art and technology, writing of books, and anything dealing with some kind of creative endeavor. The other critical part of this equation is that time is finite. So the only way you can satisfy higher needs is if you have enough time to do it. So if it takes, like back in the, say, 12,000 to 100,000 years ago, if it takes most of your time to satisfy your need for food and water then you don't have a lot of time to build shelters and clothes, and you certainly don't have time to socialize a lot and so forth. So the amount of time spent on each need level is important that takes less and less time so that you have more and more time to satisfy the higher needs, and that's the only way you can actually satisfy them is if you have the time. So let's move on to chart 13.
Okay.
chart 13 is not a very good diagram, but the idea is you have 24 hours in a day, that if you spend all your time on survival, then there's going to be no time left for security. If you spend most of your time on survival and security, then there won't be enough time for the social, material, productive realm. And if you spend, if you have enough time for all three of those, there won't be time for the influential, status-seeking part of the need hierarchy, and so forth. So each 24-hour period, you have to be able to satisfy your needs quicker and easier to allow for real progress to take place. So increases in efficiency, which is what a lot of the technology that humans create has to do with increasing efficiency. That's one of the core elements that allows us to satisfy our needs faster and easier. Let's move on to chart 14.
Okay.
Another important consideration here is that you have to think about what constitutes history, because I'm going to have to use for this approach a study of history to tell me how to quantify the past. And so the question that came up was, what is history? And basically history is the study of extremes. It's, who conquered the most, who did the most, who produced the most, who killed the most. Those kinds of things are what historians study. And to have any kind of clear mark on history, you have to have mass participation. Obviously,
Glenn,
if only one... Yes?
May I interrupt you for a second?
Okay.
Would you say that some of the economic bubbles that we have experienced throughout history can be qualified as historic extremes?
Yeah. Well, yeah, mass historic participation in buying frenzy or a panic like the crash of 87. Yeah, those are definite mass participatory events that will go down in history and be recorded as major events of our time.
So would you say, or would you propose, I should say, that any time we see mass participation in anything, then we should look out for the possibility that a historic extreme may take place?
Well, yeah, of course. The goal of this project was to try to identify what each type of behavior could be and which category of need that fit into, so then we could quantify that particular type of behavior. Like, for example, if you're spending all your time surviving, your need level would be level one, and the quantification of that period would be level one. So when I went back in history and studied all these different periods from 10,000 BC to the present, I actually subdivided every period into 100 years at a time. So that was, we're talking about 1,200 different periods of 100-year periods that I studied, and marking down what was the dominant or predominant type of behavior that the majority was participating in at that time, so I could get a reading of what the need level was at that time. Obviously, when people have a need, they're going to be focusing on fulfilling that need first before they focus on the next thing, right?
Yes.
You're not going to be worried about quantum physics when you don't have any food on the table.
Of course.
Right? So by studying what the majority of the population was doing based on a historical record, we could figure out, well, if most people are working on building shelters, then they were, majority of people were at level two of need fulfillment, and so that would give a rating of two. And so this is what I did by studying all this history. I started quantifying history going back 10,000 or 12,000 years, and I had to figure out first, though, what it was that historians looked at and how do they look at history, and that's when it came, occurred to me that they're looking at mass participation almost always. There are exceptions, of course, like, the attack on New York City for 9/11. Those kind of things go down history as historical important events, And they could be the marking point of trends, like the terrorist trend, but generally speaking, that was a more isolated event. I'm looking more for what are the majority of people doing at any point in time to decide what is the current need level that's being fulfilled, so we know what stage of development they are at in on a personal and a societal basis. Okay?
Okay.
So Maslow's oversight, I started to realize, was the fact that he never applied this to mass behavior or mass psychology. And by doing so, it started to get rid of this illusion of self-determination that, you know, that societies just go wherever they want to go and it's at everybody's own whim and your life goes the way you want it to go. A lot of these things that happen in your life are directly related to what level of need you're currently satisfying, and you can't get to certain other things until the basic needs have been met in sequential order. So let's start through the general thought process here, chart 15, that the survival instinct forces was the force that created the development of agriculture, because that more assured continuous flow of food, and obviously that enhanced survival. So the survival instinct was what created the desire, the ability or the creativity to discover agriculture. And then, of course, agriculture forces the creation of groups, which eventually could become towns and cities, because it requires lots of people to manage a large farm. And cities, once they're starting to form, or towns, start to fulfill the need to belong, which satisfies stage three of development. But when you have a city or large town or group of people, that requires cooperation, which then requires the development of laws, because people want to know what's allowed and what's not allowed and who they need to punish and who's following the rules. When there's laws, then it allows you to free your mind of uncertainty, because you have a general idea of what's going to happen, what's allowed, that you can sort of plan for the future. So instead of thinking about the here and now and about your short-term survival, you can start thinking, you know, into the future, and then maybe begin investing into the future. And that freedom of thought or freedom from uncertainty allows you to free your mind to start being more creative. And that creativity obviously starts to foster things like the music, the arts, science, technology, and all that kind of stuff. So everything happens in a sequential order, and it's a logical order based on human need. Let's move on to chart 16.
Okay.
Okay. So basically what we're showing here, what I'm trying to show here, is that history is indirect evidence of human need, and that human action is directly connected to human need, and that the fulfillment of each need requires specific action. And since historians primarily study mass human action, it became clear to me that the study of history would provide clues on the need level of a society or man at any particular point in time, as long as there was some kind of history for that particular period that you were studying. And moving on to chart 17, which will be the last chart for today.
Okay.
Because of the certainty of need, and as we know these needs are there, we know they have to be met, this allows predictability for how things are going to progress. The pursuit of a specific need implies the fulfillment of a previous. So if a society is focusing on building of shelter or making of laws and cities and socializing and so forth, then we know the previous needs had to have been met before they got to that point. So we know that it's not just random that they might have high creativity in the arts. It's not going to occur if, again, they're working on survival. So we know that previous needs are met once the current, if whatever you're working on currently, that your previous needs are met. So the style of life or the standard of living would be directly associated to the current need level that's being satisfied. And when you have an idea of the average need level of a society based on studying history, you get an idea of their standard of living. You know, if they're in cities, you obviously have an idea of what that's like. You know their other needs are being met, so you have an idea. If they're very powerful kingdoms, that are influencing other people and pushing their weight around and their power around, then you have an idea that they're in a stage four of development. That's when you're in the more political part of the development of the five stages of need. So the final conclusion was that through all of this, that I was going to be able to study history, and by using that, I could approximate living standards over thousands and thousands of years. And by approximating those living standards through this hierarchy of need, I could apply a numerical value to every 100 years from 10,000 BC all the way to the present. And once I had that numerical value applied, then I could create a chart of that and potentially predict way into the future, not only where we were, but where we were headed, and then apply wave theory to that to get some real accurate ideas of time and price and targets and all that kind of stuff. So that's what today we went over part number one. So our talk next time will be part two, and it'll be the actual process of how I did this and how I went about figuring this out and what numerical values I gave each period in history, and then the actual plotting of that, and then the final results from all of this analysis that I did starting 15 years ago.
Glenn, thank you. We will be looking forward to the next installment.